brand new episode of Graphopolicy Radio, the show that mixes comics and politics. This is the show for folks who collect presidential candidates like comic books, and there's a lot to collect right now and more that seem to show up every single day. Tonight, yeah, it was kind of a weak one, I'll admit it. So tonight, usually I do much better. So tonight we have a, now I'm all thrown off, damn it. We've got a guest, Ming Doyle, who's joining us. She's a writer and artist, was born in Boston to an Irish-American sailor and a Chinese-Canadian librarian. In 2007, she earned her BFA from Cornell University with a dual concentration in painting and drawing, and she's been working as a freelance illustrator and comic book artist ever since. She's worked with such companies as Boom, Image, Tokyo Pop, Valiant, and now DC Comics. Writing Constantina Hellblazer. Before we welcome Bing, I want to, of course, introduce my co-host, Alana, who had a hell of a weekend this weekend, getting her geek on at a really cool, brand-new convention in New York.
Oh, thanks, guys. Yeah, I cannot say enough good things about FlameCon. We're going to have an episode coming up in the future where we're going to interview one of the organizers of the convention. It was New York City's first queer geek convention, one of the first queer comic conventions in the country, and it was an amazing convention, great talent, amazing people, really inclusive space, one of the more inclusive and diverse queer spaces I've been in, so that's pretty high praise since I spent a lot of time in queer activist circles. So bravo, guys, thank you, and we'll be back to talk about that more later on.
Yes.
And in the meantime, we get to talk about a comic that is very well worthy of FlameCon. Being a comic that has sexual diversity and representation in it as well. I'll leave it to you to introduce, Brett.
Yeah, so it came out last week. Constantine the Hellblazer is DC Comics, one of their new series that's coming out for their post-convergence big event. It basically takes the, I would say, somewhat classic character of John Constantine with a new creative team, and one of the team is Ming, who is joining us. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I guess the first thing we always like to start off with creators is, so you went to school for art and, partially for art, and you started working, like, illustrating and doing comics ever since. Like, how did you go from school to the actual, like, comic book industry?
Yeah, well, I actually went to school for just art. I went to a fine art department for studio painting and drawing. And the career track after that, when you graduate, is generally either go into, like, the New York City gallery scene or just don't have a job, which is what most people do. That's what most people end up doing. So I didn't actually want to become a gallery artist so much. I just went to art school because I love drawing, and I figured I would have to do kind of more of a commercial route, but right after graduating, I didn't feel prepared. I didn't know what I was going to do, if I was going to get into commercials or illustration or what. So I just went home, lived with my parents very kindly for a year or two, and just...
Hello?
Uh-oh. It looks like she just dropped off. Nope. Hopefully she'll be calling back in a few minutes.
I'm going to see if I can DM her that she has been dropped, because she probably thinks that we can still hear her. Shoot.
Yes, I'll mark that phone number. Oh, there we go. I believe she's back.
Hi, back. I think I got booted off.
Sorry.
But I'm back. Yeah, no, so I just was at home doing some fan art and rewatching some cartoons from my youth. Stumbled upon Batman the Animated Series, rewatched it all, and just started drawing my own interpretations of the characters without knowing much about them, and just posting them online. And through that, they got picked up at some websites like Project Rooftop, which is a site that specialized in superhero redesign contests, and just general, news blogs. This was back in 2007 or 8 or so. And eventually editors started seeing my art and just emailing me and asking if I wanted to draw real comics. So, it was a very, very social media beginning. And I got all most of my work in comics before I even went to a single convention or met anyone face to face in the industry.
Wow. That's amazing.
But I think more and more that's the way. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask a very arty question, which did you find it challenging going from doing like 10 ups to doing actual sequential art and like telling stories in that way?
Oh my gosh, it was so difficult because I had seen comics growing up and I'd read a couple of single issues usually whenever I was in a convenience store because they still had spinner racks in convenience stores back then. I would just grab some single issue of X-Men or something that was totally out of sequence. I remember the first single issue I read was X-Men back when they were doing the Phalanx saga. It was like a total holographic foil Rob Liefeld cover, and I just picked it up because it was so shiny, and it was like issue number 7 out of however many that were in there, so I had no idea what was going on, but I read that book over and over probably for a whole month, and that was it. So I really didn't know much about comics, and of course now these days they have entire programs at schools for becoming a comic book artist. And I think if you go to one of those, it certainly helps. But I, like a lot of people, I think, just decided, well, I have some facility for drawing. I want to try and figure out what comic books are, how they work. And, you just learn that by reading a ton of comics and a lot of trial and error in your own work. And it was hard. It was hard. I drew probably over 1,000 pages before I felt like I knew what I was doing.
There's a lot of artists who make really beautiful pinups who just cannot make the transition to like actually, drawing a comic. So it's impressive, to be able to do that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree, and I don't know that I completely have a full facility at it yet either. I mean, it's definitely something I feel like I'm always working at and learning. I think some people just innately really understand how to present a story in the sequential format like that, and for other people like me, it's definitely more of a learned, studied, applied skill. But it's fun. And I like to view it a lot as storyboarding for a movie or something and kind of an opportunity to direct your own film.
Is there anyone particularly that you kind of stuck with to learn from, like checking out comics?
Oh, geez, this is really embarrassing. But when I decided that I wanted to get into comics, I went to Amazon.com and I clicked on the graphic novel section and I just read the top 10 best-selling ones. So it was like, Dark Knight and Watchmen and all that stuff. And I don't know. I haven't actually stuck with a single artist. I have favorite artists that I can point to, like Becky Cloonan and Paul Pope and people like that. But everyone has such a different style. It's hard to, everyone has their own voice. It's like, I don't think, I'm also ashamed to say I haven't actually read any of like the Scott McCloud textbooks or any of those classics that teach you how to draw comics correctly. I probably should have done that instead of just like jumping head first and being like, oh, this is a comic book. I'm going to try and replicate it myself. I probably should have learned
some
building blocks first.
But you figured it out. So in terms of art, like when you were creating your own art style in art school, like were there particular artists who you did a lot of, who you studied a lot of or were particularly inspired by from the fine arts side?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I liked a lot of the more illustrative kind of late 19th, early 20th century illustrators like Egon Schiele and Gustav Klimt. I really liked Aubrey Beardsley. Yeah, Aubrey Beardsley for sure. Edward Gorey, I really like a lot. And I'm also hugely influenced by the Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark illustrations. So anything from all over the place, pretty much.
Well, I really felt like the Schiele influence in your art is really, really clear, but it does not at all look like derivative. It just is sort of like when you listed the name of artists that you were like, I was like, I've seen all of that in your work, but your work is still clearly always yours. I think one of the things that I most appreciate about your art is that I can always tell what your pieces are, even though you're not doing exactly the same thing in every single place.
Thank you so much. I mean, it's definitely important for people to have their own recognizable visual voice and kind of signature look, I think.
I think so. And one of the things we talked a lot about on the podcast are, you know, there was a period of time where there's been a really specific house style in comics. And there were periods of time in comics where the house style was one that I might like. Currently, I generally hate all of the house styles, so I'm really excited to see that the comics are going more towards letting people have greater individuality in their art. And your book, which you didn't, you know, you're not drawing Constantine, although, oh my God, I'd love your cover, and we'll need to talk about that at some point, is that, you know, this comic is not house style. This comic is, you know, is very much in the style of the artist who's working on it, Russ Moe. So, I think that maybe there's more space again now at DC for some more stylistic, different, unique artist styles happening.
Yeah, I think in general there's a huge move towards more diverse, personalized voices in comics, and you know we really have to credit the indie comic movement. A lot of the books coming out from Image being so popular, and also I think the proliferation of web comics recently. Because it's shown people that comics can look so many different ways and still be wildly successful. And, you know, a style that previously people at larger companies might have thought wouldn't find an audience, they can now see through the internet, through fan art, through personal art just posted on Tumblr, that quite a lot of people actually do like these more personal, out there styles. And I think that makes people in general who are in positions of power in publishing companies feel more comfortable with taking some risks, because a lot of times people just want something a little different, a little fresh, and from a sideways point of view.
Mm-hmm. So how did you go from doing the art to actually writing a series?
Well, that is interesting. I mean, some of the first... yeah, exactly. Some of the first... comics work I did actually was back when, I mean, you mentioned, you know, I started out just doing pinups and then getting asked to do comics, and that is pretty much true, but I also did a few short story fan art, fan comics that I posted to my live journal, to give you a clue of how long ago this was, where I would write them and, you know, then illustrate them, and that was just part of the process of me figuring out what I wanted my voice in comics to be, how I wanted to tell stories, and so on. And one of the short stories that I wrote and illustrated back then was a really, really short, like, six-page deal called Lady Gotham, which was about Martha Wayne, right before she married Thomas Wayne. And I used it kind of just as, like, a character study of her and her opinions and thoughts, because she was kind of such a female mother figure cipher that I wanted to see if I could try and find a personality in there. So I put that up on my live journal, and, you know, it was popular at the time. I got a lot of comments from people on my friends list. I think some people saw it, but that was like back in 2007 or so. Yeah, early 2007, I think. And then it came at some point last year that I started talking to Mark Doyle, who's an editor over at DC, and he asked me to pitch a couple of story concepts for him for a few different characters. And I was like, Mark, you know, I've always really wanted to write, but how did you think of me? Like, I'm not known as a writer. I haven't done a ton of writing. I mean, periodically over the years, I've done a few of my own 8-page anthology stories that I've also drawn, but, you know, like, nothing that you could really point to. And Mark was like, well, I saw your Lady Gotham fan comic back on LiveJournal. And keep in mind, this was something I did in 2007, and he was talking to me about it in 2014. And he's like, so I know you can write. So how would you feel
about
pitching some of your ideas? Yeah, I know. Isn't that the wildest thing? So, I mean, I was like, well, sure. You know, I've never written a comic book story longer than 8 pages, but I have a lot of ideas I love to write. Here are some thoughts. At that point in time, you know, he didn't go with any of my pitches. I wrote a few. But, of course, I wasn't upset at all, because I was like, you know, thanks for letting me pitch to you. That was great practice and great fun. But then a few months later, some more people at DC called me up again, and they're like, so how would you feel about Constantine? Have you ever heard of the character Constantine? Do you want to write him? And, yeah, I signed a pitch in, and they're like, great, you're hired.
Wow. Can I just say real briefly how important I think it is that the character that you chose to write your like fan fiction about was a voiceless female mother figure who's just like nobody's ever cared to like express upon. And I'm only peripherally, like, I have friends who are very involved in the fanfic communities, and it's not something I've really kept up on, but I've actually heard of your piece, and that's kind of crazy.
You had heard of Lady Gotham, too?
Yes,
wow.
I had it.
Wow, that's funny.
And so, like, it's known, but I think it's such a wonderfully feminist thing to do, to, like, have the story be a Martha Wayne story, which is something that no one has ever touched before, because nobody thought she was worth talking about, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that, you know, focusing on kind of an underrepresented character like that, it's kind of a cheap and easy way to write a completely original character, but attach it to a more successful franchise, A. But then B, it's also a way to think about maybe why that character isn't successful or hasn't been talked about more. And when I looked at Martha Wayne, I was like, oh, it's because she's a mom. People aren't that excited about moms. They're just kind of tools for how to get to the hero of the story, which in most cases is usually a gallant dude. And I was like, you know, I'm a woman. I come from a mother. She's an amazing person. Maybe I'll be a mother. I don't want to just fade into being kind of a voiceless, faceless, string of pearls, empty figure that nobody cares about anymore. I want to go in and explore this, you know, loving dead mother trope and try to put some humanity in there. So I think just by doing that, and again, this is back in 2007 when really not many people have thought about Martha Wayne at all. I mean, I think since there have been some story arcs where she's shown up and had more of a personality. It got a lot of people's attention. And I mean, also for people who want to break into comics, because that's probably the first question I get from everyone at conventions. How do I become a comic artist or writer? How do I break in? I always say to them, you know, if you want to be an artist, if you have an idea of the kind of art you want to be drawing, the kind of comics you want to be working on, just draw that art for yourself and put it out there. In social media these days, it's so easy to represent yourself, and you don't even have to be published at all to become immensely popular and kind of like a member of the community. You know, people, you can be a peer basically with Jim Lee if you have an Instagram and he likes your work. So you can just put that stuff out there. If you want to write, you know, again, like write some stuff and put it out there. And also if you want to be a writer artist, do it. You know, like Becky Cloonan is a great example of that also. She did some writing for Tokyo Pop way back in the day with East Coast Rising when they were trying to make American manga happen, and she also went ahead and self-published her own Eisner Award-winning book, Wolf, you know? So I know that she's writing more, that she got Gotham Academy. Some editors saw that her writing won an Eisner and were like, great, she can write too. Hire her.
Mm-hmm.
So do what you want to do and get it done. The end.
I feel like this is going to be a no-duh response on this one, but I mean, it seems like it's got to be easier now with social media to, like, empower creators and get it out there themselves. Like, it's really democratized comics as a whole.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, completely. High school kids are making amazing web comics that are getting picked up for publishing deals, you know? Like, that's the kind of environment we're in now.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying. You know, if you can write and or draw, and you know how to input content into a website, you can do it. I mean, there's such a hunger now for content. That's one thing. That's kind of a phrase you hear bandied around a lot, that content is king. But absolutely, in this kind of frenetic, really short attention span culture we have now, where people are always looking for the next clickhole article or the next big thing to rave about for the day or whatever. If you can just keep making content and putting it out there, it's going to find a home. I mean, it might not be instantaneous. Like, you can make a webcomic or an illustration that you think is really amazing and it gets, like, 100 notes on Tumblr and that's it. But you never know. It might be a case of, like, me with Lady Gotham, where you do something and then 5 or 7 or 10 years later, it circles back around into the popularity reading cycle. And you know, whatever you put out there, you'll reap what you sow.
Do you think it's the
content? I do think it's important also that you have something to say. Like, I think there's a lot of people who don't really have an aesthetic developed yet or particular aims, you know, or that they want to come across. And I think in having to have that specifically is important.
As well. And I mean, I think you can have something to say with just an aesthetic as well. I mean, if you're just an artist and you're not a writer, I mean, you can, readers pick up a lot of a story from just one image as well. You know, if you just want to do, like, cool, flashy pinups, that's fine. I mean, you can draw pinups that are kind of at, like, the Transformers movie level in terms of thinking. Yeah, and, you know, it's something that will be popular that people like to look at but don't really linger on. But then, you know, you also have artists, I think, that, you know, aren't necessarily or don't consider themselves writers that will do a pinup that tells such a story or has such a strong authorial viewpoint, even though it's just an image with no writing, that I think you can have a tremendous amount to say with just art. But, of course, if you want to write as well, it is important to actually try and say something with your writing, too. That is true.
Oh, speaking of authorial viewpoint, we haven't talked about Constantine yet. I definitely want to talk about the cover. Maybe this is a decent transition moment.
Sure. Yeah. Let's talk about this cover.
So I love the official cover. The official cover. Sorry, I like just made up my headset fly off. So I love the comics cover. That's the actual official cover of the book. But I also definitely need to give a shout out
to my pornographic cover
to the variant that you did. When I actually first saw at Special Edition New York City, the variant. I guess I can post it on Twitter right now easily.
I was just about to do it.
Oh yeah, go do that, Brett. Thank you. Which is, I think, one of the most singular covers I've seen on a comic book by a publisher of the big two ever. So, one, mazel tov on that, because that's saying something, is great art. But I also feel like this is the most, like, sexualized male pinup that has ever happened on the front of a comic book. So I want to congratulate you for doing that. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. Hello?
Hi. You know?
Hello? I can hear
Hello?
You a bit.
Hello?
There we
there
go.
You go. Yes,
still?
Here I am.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I came back. Well, thank you so much. And I really do have to say thank you to the editorial team for letting that one go through. The editorial team at all levels, the assistant, the senior, the group, and the big publishers, because I thought for sure it wasn't going to happen, but they're like, no, you know, you're on Constantine. You guys want to make him young and sexy. You want to bring your viewpoint to it. We should absolutely let you do a cover that expresses that. So I was shocked and very happy. It is totally kind of like a Marvel swimsuit-looking image, but, I, you know, with, like, some extra mystique and classiness. He's lounging a bed of hell eyes, so.
Yes. The coloring on the cover is gorgeous. I mean, did you do the color yourself?
Oh, thank you. Yes, I did. Whenever I do a cover, I always like to do my own coloring as well.
Because your pieces are initially painted, right?
No. Actually, most of my art, I'm going to say 98% of it, is digital. And then I'll just go ahead into Photoshop and color it. But for that piece, I drew John's face and his upper body in ink. That cover is actually funny because I started off just kind of doodling my idea of John, even though I wasn't drawing the comic, just to kind of give myself an excuse to get into the headspace of working on it. So I doodled that head and the chest and the arms, and I was like, no, this is kind of sexy. So then I scanned it in because I'd reached the edge of the paper, and then I continued it out into the full pinup in Photoshop. And by the time I finished drawing, I was like, we have got a full-size centerfold pinup cover here now.
Yeah. That's really cool to hear that's how the picture started. I mean, So this was early then. This was really early in your writing process. This was you were trying to put a face to what you were writing, no? Or was...
Yeah, I mean, before we'd even written issue one, I drew that. So it was definitely very early on. And maybe that was good because, you know, I drew it and I brought it with me in person to show to a few of my editors when I went to New York. Well, D.C. was still in New York. And they saw it, and at the time, no one was talking about making it a cover or anything. They were just like, oh, that's a nice drawing of John. And then, like, a couple months later, one of my editors circled back and was like, that nice, sexy picture of John you drew, you want to expand that and turn it into a cover? And I was like, yeah, great. So once again, planting the seeds which you wish to sow. If you want to have a really sexy Constantine cover out there in the future, just send the idea out into the universe early on.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. And so how much of the new character design that you guys worked on came from your early designs on this, and how much came from Rosmo, and was it something that you guys developed individually or together?
Yeah. Well, I'd say that Riley is pretty much 100% responsible for the look, the new updated look of Constantine. When we first approached him to be the artist, he was like, yes, this is a dream job. I've always loved the idea of Constantine. We just asked if he could update him a bit, and Riley sent us a few pages worth of, like, possible new directions that John could go, and everything ranging from just, you know, him in the classic trench coat and tie and scruffy face, but just younger, to things as out there as, like, wearing kind of a Tron outfit with a DJ Deadmau5 helmet, because we were talking about we wanted him to have, like, a musical background. So... he sent us everything that way, and together collectively as a creative team, we kind of took bits of pieces of his drawing and drawings and settled on something that we all really liked a lot. And it's funny because in issue one, John has his pants tucked into his boots military style, and I thought that was very sexy and good. And then Riley just sent us an email last week. He's like, hey, for the next issue, can I draw him with his pants rolled up in kind of a punk cuff? And we're like, yes, you can do that. And I thought it was funny that he had to ask, because I think it is so much the superhero mentality that somebody has to have a specific look and they just look like that forever. And that may be why I get so many people coming up to me on Twitter and at conventions asking me if I'm going to bring the trench coat back to John. It's like, it's not John Constantine if he's not wearing that trench coat. And that's patently ridiculous. I mean, if you look at the earliest possible runs of John Constantine, he barely ever wore a trench coat. Sure, he did sometimes, but a lot of times he showed up in, like, an electric blue three-piece suit with pinstripes on it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he wore different things. He's John Constantine no matter what he wears. So it's really funny that people attach so much of a character to their clothes and comic books these days.
What's iconic and what isn't, and I think you guys are doing something that's iconic but not generic and not, like, the same exact look we've always seen.
I mean, another thing about the pinup that that I drew of him for the cover, in my pinup variant cover, he's wearing a short leather jacket. And I had prints of that available at a show, and people came by, and everybody was like, oh, look, John Constantine. Nobody was like, who is that? I can't tell. Where's the trench coat? You know, a character can look like a character, but still, you know, you can still tweak the edges, so.
Mm-hmm.
How familiar were you?
Very much captured in the attitude.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. John is not the trench coat. He would be really very offended, I think, if anyone said he was a trench coat, if they boiled him down to that. He might feel
about the skinny
even
tie.
More objectified than my female gaze to him on that cover did. I think he'd be happy about the female gaze of my drawing and unhappy about being reduced to a trench coat.
I'm going to write that right now. Thank you.
You are welcome.
How much in the past, like, for, you know, before you got pitched of the, hey, would you like to take this on, you know, were you familiar with the character? Like, did you read previews like Hellblazer and all that, or?
Oh, my goodness. This is another case where I'm sure I'm going to get myself in trouble. But I had read some of him. because I read all of Sandman when I was first discovering what comic books were. And John is a character that pops in and out of Neil Gaiman's Sandman runs, or, you know, his ancestor, Lady Johanna Constantine, does, and he does by extension. So I knew of him through that. And also, when I was in college, I got a free ticket to a campus screening of the new Keanu Reeves Constantine movie. So I saw that. And you know what? You know what? I liked it. I liked that movie. I'm just going to say it. But that was my idea of Constantine. I mean, I obviously knew that the character of Constantine in comics was a gruff English guy who was always smoking the cigarette and had the stubble. Just like, you know, I know that Wolverine is Logan, Old Man Logan, and that his claws used to be bone or whatever, but I haven't necessarily read all of his run. Like, I just had the idea of who Constantine was as a character. But I hadn't read all of his run. I didn't know everything about him. So when they approached me about the idea to write Constantine, I just told the editor straight up, I was like, you know, listen, I like the concept of Constantine, but I'm not a diehard fan. I don't know everything about him. In fact, I don't know a ton about him. And they just said, that's all right. We're looking for a fresh perspective and a new take on him. You can catch up on who he is. We'll help you with the continuity if you need it. But just tell us what you would like to see in a character like that. So that's what I did. And then once they actually got into the work of writing, that was the point where both I and James Tynan, my co-writer, who also hadn't read a lot of Constantine, if any, were sent a bunch of PDFs, like 900, 2,000 page long PDFs by DC Editorial of all the big Constantine runs. And then we read those all. But yeah, like previously when I was just working on the idea of him, I wasn't that familiar.
Mm. One of the things that I really noticed reading the comic is I felt that the narration, mm-hmm. I could not hear it in any, I heard Matt Wagner, the actor from the TV show's voice, reading it like the entire time, so strongly. I don't know if the script for this predated the show or not.
The script
very loud.
I think.
In my head.
Well, that's awesome. I don't know if it predated the show or not either, because I'm not sure exactly when it started running. But I personally haven't seen the show yet. I have it bookmarked on Hulu, and I am going to watch it. But I didn't want to watch it at the time, and I still don't want to watch it yet because I'm settling into the voice of writing Constantine. So uh-huh. I didn't want to get involved in something that I might end up consciously aping or anything like that. But if you do read it and you hear the Constantine TV show voice saying all that stuff, then to me, I think that's great because that means that both I and the writers of that show really had a strong core understanding of the character.
Yeah, I definitely think don't watch it for the reasons you said. And I think that's really cool. Yeah, it was so clear. Like, I don't usually have that level of having a specific person
in
my head when I'm reading it.
It kind of sucks because I do really want to watch the show because that's the kind of media that I like consuming in my free time. But I just feel like I want to, you know, get a bunch of issues under my belt before I even venture over there.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Can I talk to you a little bit about the middle page spread in the comic? The answer to this question might just be ask the artist. But this is very special, like how you guys have these different stripes of layers of hell. The mm-hmm. demon character is walking John through these different layers of hell. They are staged, by the way, inside perhaps a production of Sleep No More, the immersive theater show in New York City.
Basically, yes.
So there's a lot of New York stuff in here, but I guess I'll wait and come back to that point. So as they get to lower, in the beginning, you know, there's a level that's like gluttony, and in the level of gluttony, there's gluttony happening. In the level of greed, there are people swimming around in gold bullion. As you get further down, things get less and less literal. So when you're on the second floor, the seventh circle of hell, which is violence, what's happening on the stage is a circus performance. And then the first floor, the frog circle, the fraud is a man being chased by tiny dragons. So I was trying to think about, is this like about the process getting more and more absurd, or is there something that I'm not quite getting in terms of literally? And I think it's hilarious, and I love it, and I just wanted to see if there's anything you could help me gather on that, just because I think it's such a funny thing.
Well, thank you so much. The concept for that double page spread, in terms of just turning the book physically around in order to read it horizontally instead of just in the regular format, came from our editor, Andy Corey. He was like, I just want to see more books do crazy things like this. What do you think about actually making readers turn a book upside down? We were like, great. The idea for a Sleep No More production, I think, came out of all of us. But again, actually, Andy might have brought that up. I'm not sure. But yeah, it was a group idea. And then I actually wrote those two pages, so I am in a position to tell you what was going on there. So that's very lucky. So I have not read all of Dante's Inferno. I'm going to admit that straight up. I haven't read it cover to cover.
You're a fangirl.
I know. I know. But I do have access to Wikipedia. So I went. I looked at all the levels of hell as described in Dante's Inferno. And there were very thorough Sparks Note level descriptions of everything. They're like, you know, greed, you know, men with bullion and everything like that. But then I was reading, and so for the first few levels, I felt very comfortable just being like, all right, this is what it says Dante Inferno's level looks like. So Riley, here's the description, draw something like that. But then as I got further down, I was like, this is very by the books. I'm getting kind of sick of it. when we got to a level like violence, which is described as people in almost kind of gladiatorial arenas doing combat for all time, locked in battles with creatures and bears and things, I was like, Riley, you know, it says it's like this, but if you want to, you know, interpret that and, like, make it the rings, like, of a circus ring instead of the rings of an gladiatorial arena, I think that'd be great. And, you know, just further on, it devolved more and more. You know, there's levels with giants, there's levels with dragons snatching babies, and I was like, put it in a graveyard, put it in this or that. So I gave those descriptions to Riley, and he was like, I also, in my descriptions, was like, but do whatever the idea of that concept inspires in you. And so he also injected his own viewpoint into it. So it was like that whole double page spread was such a huge collaborative process from all the editors, writers, and the artists. It was just like a big party. We all got in on it. And I think everyone was really excited to do something that format-wise was quite different from what you see in a usual monthly comic. So we were all very invested in making it something fun for readers to look at.
It definitely is fun. And I feel like, I mean, I laughed because I just liked how it got less and less literal and more absurd. Like, that joke really...
That's kind of like John's life. I'm great. I'm glad you liked that.
Totally. And then I have a question, which is, can we get Momofuku to cater for us? Because currently, I don't think they do catering. One of our website contributors for graphic policy, Sarah Rasher, was joking that she wants to live in a world where Momofuku caters, but not at the expense of Hell's Kitchen not gentrifying. So we find ourselves in a complicated state of wish fulfillment in our comics. I think you have to remember
that the Inferno is being run by a demon, and if a demon wanted to make Momofuku cater for them, he could probably find a way.
It's a good point. They're so manipulative, like everyone else in this comic. Character design for Blythe. Was that something?
Again, that was totally. No, that was totally our artist Riley Rosmo. The description of Blythe, as we gave it to him, was that Blythe is a completely genderless creature. Like it was a demon from hell. It just kind of made a glance at a human and got an idea of the basic form. It was like, oh, I want to be that and attractive and stuff, but didn't look close enough to care to really look close enough to delineate a gender or get down into the specifics. So holding on to a lot of the demon qualities of its nature and just kind of getting the base form of the human down. And when we're writing Blythe and everything, we were writing them completely gender fluid. Or not even gender fluid, but more just like Blythe is a demon. You know, Blythe doesn't subscribe to the human idea of gender at all. Blythe just shows up and wants to look fabulous and looks how they look. So we gave that description to Riley, and this is the design that he came up with. And Blythe is wearing a very fabulous bulbous red scarf that sometimes when you look at it kind of looks like cherry blossoms or something, or just big fat feathers. And other times when you look at it, you can see that it's made out of big fat demon tongues. I really liked what he did. And of course, it gave Blythe really fabulous kind of cloven high heels that are actually just part of Blythe's legs. They're not shoes. I liked the look that he settled on. I thought it was great.
We actually have a question from Twitter, and something that I wanted to ask at one point, too, so this is a very good question. So Constantine is supposed to be English, and is that, you know, that speaking style or slang or any of that, like, you have issues writing that at all as far as the dialogue or something you're comfortable with?
Yeah.
Or kind of something to get away with or move away from?
Yeah, well, James and I are both, you know, your standard issue Americans. So that is difficult. Most of my experience of the English vernacular comes from just watching BBC dramas or whatever on Netflix. So I was very self-conscious about writing in a style that would at least, if not be completely believable, at least not be flagrantly disrespectful and angering to British audiences. And luckily, actually, my writer on the Vertigo series, The Kitchen, which I just finished illustrating, Ollie Masters, is himself English. So I sent him a couple of messages asking for some Brit picking help early on. Like, hey, how would you say this? Would you say it like this? Oh, you don't have that word over there? It doesn't mean that? Okay, great. So it's really just... I try not to write anything that I think sounds too overtly American, and I just kind of ask questions when I really need it, and for the most part, hope for the best. But, I mean, I think some of the best Constantine writers, like Brian Azzarello, have been American, so hopefully it comes across okay. And likewise, you know, a lot of the great, you know, Batman writers have been British, so uh-huh. As long as you get an idea across pretty well, hopefully the nationality vernacular blunders won't get in anyone's way too much. If there are any, I could kind of just inadvertently be writing perfect British slang, but I very highly doubt it.
Well, you brought it up, so I think it's kind of a good segue a little bit into it, and we don't need to talk tons about it. It's about the Vertigo series, The Kitchen, which I think the last issue's out this week. Yeah, I love the series. I'm a huge, like, mob story fan, so, like, I'm in love with this miniseries.
Oh, my gosh.
As an artist, like, it's a period piece in the 70s, right, I think?
Yeah.
Isn't it right?
Yeah. It spans, I think, from 77 to 79, so
yeah,
late 70s.
I know. They just mentioned the Son of Sam in it in, like, whatever issue, 6 or 7. So all the art's very, like, from that time, like, what type of research did you do to, like, come up with the outfits, or did you just kind of,
thank,
like,
you so
it?
Much. Yeah, I, well...
Even the cars,
I mean, I
the
did
cars
wing it to a,
the time.
I did wing it to a certain extent because I am not from the 70s, but a lot of the vibe I actually remember from my own life because I was born in 84, and a lot of the junk from the 70s was still kind of hanging around when I was gaining consciousness as a human being, you know, wood-paneled station wagons and all that stuff. Because when a decade ends, it doesn't just kind of, like, snap shut. A lot of traces of it linger. So I looked at my own memories. And then also my mother is a reference librarian, and she knows more about comics than I do at this point, I think, because once I started doing comics, she got really into the genre and started reading up on it like a reference librarian will. And when I told her I was doing this period 70s piece, she looked up a bunch of great coffee table books of photography from the era and everything, and sent them my way. And also my editor, Will Dennis, sent me some reference books as well. And we were bandying around a lot of links to photo documentations of Times Square at the time and things like that. So I looked at it just a ton of reference photography. And also, I relied on my good friend Netflix to watch some films from the era, like Dog Day Afternoon and The Taking of Pelham 123. And I just kind of tried to get into that mindset. And I love fashion. I love clothing. So for me, one of the big ways to to get into the era was to try and understand the clothes. So I did it. I went for all of the high-waisted pants that created that, like, really attractive kind of mom pooch belly. And I made all the flares, not bell bottoms from the 90s, but flares. And I tried to go for some gross polyester tops and disgusting patterns. And, yeah, we just really went into it. And when it came, and luckily our writer Ollie also, and our editor Will, would specify if there needed to be like a certain model of car or make of something, they would specify, and I could just Google search for it. So if you're an artist these days, you're really kind of, you have an embarrassment of references in order to access, in order to get into different stories that are from outside your own point of view. I was just, as I was doing all this and, you know, clicking around on the internet and just watching movies instantaneously streaming, I was just thinking back to the days when guys and gals who were drawing comics had to have literal reference folders, like file cabinets of pictures they flipped to magazines to try and see what things looked like. And I was just imagining what hell that must have been.
Absolutely. Those are such great graphic movies. Like, I love picking up Hell Monkey 3. I'm such a sucker for that movie. It has a really strong sense of place. Like, that's like kind of the point of the film. And I mean, how much do you think that this, I guess Constantine, maybe he'll be hitting the road eventually, but how much do you feel like the story you're telling in this comic is about a specific place?
Yeah. I mean, I think Constantine is less about a specific place than the kitchen is, certainly, because, I mean, the kitchen has the place right there in the title. It's about these girls that live in this neighborhood, and, like, that's their domain, that's their queendom. But Constantine, I know that's the right way to say it, but I just default to Constantine. Constantine time. So John, when we start with him, he's in New York City, and he's been there for a while. You know, it's not to say that he'll always be there. I think because he's such an kind of occult layabout and ne'er-do-well, of course, we're probably going to take him all over the world and probably back to his hometown and all that good stuff. And, of course, we'll try to get all of that as right as we can. It's hard, you know. I mean, I do know some people who live in England or who have relatives from there, and of course I like to try and ask them for details, and I'm sure James has his resources that he likes to call from as well. But I think whenever you can, it's a good idea to just, you know, do as much of your due diligence as you can, and whenever it's possible, slip a little bit of truth in with your storytelling to give it that little bite of, oh, maybe there's something real in here to back it up.
I definitely thought that the New York pieces, I mean, I live in New York, as you can imagine from my username on everything, and I thought that the New York context was all really, really good. I think another thing that I was gratifying for a lot of folks to see is that the last time there was a bisexual anti-hero character introduced in a comic, it was a guy, the comic was by a writer who's an outstanding writer, nevertheless was handled in a very clumsy way where it felt like it was just like a performance of trying to have the character like perform being bi so that everyone in the readership could see it. I thought that the way you guys presented in this comic was, like, great and just completely narrative and natural and not at all ridiculous. So I wanted to applaud that, one. Say it's really exciting also that, you know, your co-creator, you know, like, being, like, a queer comics maker who's working on a comic about a queer character is awesome. And sort of see, like, you know, how you guys have approached writing, you know, a bisexual drawing with Constantine after a time period in which that question has been pretty contested because of the television show and people's reactions to that.
Yeah, I mean, I actually was pretty surprised when I was reading on Twitter that Constantine in the TV show wasn't bisexual, because it seems like such a non-deal to me that somebody would be bisexual in a TV show like that. I mean, it's bizarre that people kind of quailed at that. But, yeah, you know, James is a bisexual man, and that's something that he's very interested in portraying realistically, so he does that very well. I'm a huge romance fan, just of the genre, and I'm a human being, and I have some empathy. So I also was pretty down with just writing John from a human perspective, and not so much, you know, getting, I think, I don't know what it is, honestly. I think maybe sometimes people view being bisexual or gay or trans anything or a anything as being such an exotic feature almost, that they get hung up on that to the point where they're like, ooh, they almost kind of try to write around it so much that it comes across sounding kind of really false, or sometimes maybe even kind of fetishized, but in any case not,
yes,
like a natural part of the character.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's just so alien from my viewpoint in terms of how to approach a character or in terms of the media that I enjoy consuming. You know, I don't like it if I watch a movie and they're like, oh, it's gay and these gay men are kissing, or, oh, it's blue is the warmest color and women are in love this time. Oh, I don't know. I didn't say blue is the warmest color, but a lot of the writing about it and the reviews are so sensationalized in that manner that I was like, wow, compelling. But I just like human interest stories. So I think we just treat John as a human foremost, and, you know, by extension, he is who he is. And I don't think, like, in his life, where he does the kinds of things that he does and he is the way that he is, the fact that he enjoys sleeping with men and women should be, like, the least remarkable thing about him.
Was there any conscious, like, decision as far as that to make that part of the first issue? Because, I mean, going into it, I'm like, I don't know what to expect. You know, there's been so many takes of the character, and then there's a kind of controversy around the television show. Like, I don't know. And then I kind of got to that scene. I'm like, wait, he's flirting with the guy behind the counter. Holy shit, he's flirting with the guy. I'm like, hallelujah, this is amazing. Like, DC said that they wanted to have, you know, a broad representation, and they're doing it. Like, this is fantastic to see. Like, was there a thought of, like, all right, we're doing this, and we're going in, like, right away and just kind of, like, making this part of the first issue? Or it was it's just naturally part of the issue, and this is how he would act going into a diner with some cute guy behind it?
Well, after all of my talk about humanity and just basic empathy, I feel like I should say it was just really natural, and like, oh, if he's in a diner, he'd flirt with anyone, and it was just kind of a cast-off thing. But no, absolutely, from the beginning, James and I were like, and we want to have him flirting with a man in the first issue. Not just because it's a man, but just because one of the most important things that James and I care about with Constantine is, you know, his character, him at his soul. And both he and I really want to write John showing all aspects of that, you know, his asshole side, but also, like, his softer romantic side. And we definitely want to get into a point, like, I mean, who knows how the series will go and how it will continue to be received by people, but I hope that we can be doing it long enough that we can set up some major love interests from John that are men and women that will come back and be with him in future arcs and issues that won't just be kind of like one-off scenes. I mean, of course, that's very dangerous for anyone who gets involved with John, but people do get involved with John. That's the source of his misery a lot of the times. And we'd like to just give him the full gamut there. So we wanted to jump in right away and just be like, you know, he is flirting with this guy when he's talking to Blythe in the Inferno. They also talk about one of John's ex-girlfriends. You know, he just is who he is, and we wanted to put that out there straight up because we knew that there have been so few gay and bi characters recently in mainstream comics that it was something that people were going to be really wanting to see, and it was something, frankly, that James and I wanted to see as well. You know, that was the first question that he and I asked the editors when we were signing on to do this. We're like, can he be bi? Like, is that something that we can do? Because if it wasn't something that they were going to be cool with, then that would have absolutely affected my view of taking on the job and the whole series. But the editors have been amazing, and the publishers have been great, and everyone has been really behind John just being who he is and going back to the key roots, and also, you know, emphasizing some of the new traits and really bringing him forward in a respectful manner that is still true to him, but leaves more room to build on things in the future. So I'm really happy with the way the whole creative process is going.
Cool. Does it also go with the smoking? Like, the other thing I think of, like, iconic about this character is him lighting up cigarettes every so often. And I know you have a cigarette in the variant, and I honestly can't remember in the first issue if he smokes at all. And I don't have it in front of me. So it's one of those, like, did that come up at all?
Yeah, he does.
Okay.
And it's John will be smoking in every issue. Yeah, absolutely. He'll be smoking in all issues, probably every other panel. And I was surprised by that too. I mean, honestly, to me, it actually felt really natural because I'm just coming off of drawing the kitchen, where every other panel somebody's lighting up a fag and talking about it and like grinding something under the heel or whatever. So tons of smoking back in the 70s. And I feel also silly saying this, but it didn't even occur to me that the smoking might be censored, because I was so hung up on making sure that we could make John buy, and I had just come off of the kitchen that we were writing, and James and I were just writing in the script. We were like, John lights a cigarette and does this or that, and we never got a comment on it from the editors. So we're just like, well, it's happening. There it goes. But, you know, one thing I'm happy about is, even though, and again, the kitchen was at Vertigo, so I'm so used to just having every swear word and invective on the planet hurled around on the pages, and we can't do that with John, so we have to bleep it out. But we're still, even though they're bleeped out and we can't show exactly all of the things that we could show if we were a Vertigo mature title, we did get the teen rating 15+ at DC for this title. And it's absolutely for issues of nudity more and themes. And we're very happy about that because, you know, when you're writing John from an all-ages perspective, I'm not saying that you can't do that successfully, but it definitely, you know, it's a handicap because John isn't an all-ages character at all. So we're happy that we have a bit more wiggle room and leeway. And if you see a lot of little start out blanks, you know, just fill it in.
When do they decide the ratings? Like, when you're pitching it, or like when during the pitch do they say, hey, this is what it's going to be rated, or is that decided after?
Well, when we were developing it, and we weren't really sure what the rating was going to be at all, but all of our editors told us they were going to push really hard to get the mature rating. I think people were really hoping that Constantine would be DC Proper's first mature title, I think, or if not first, at least one of the few of all time mature titles at DC Comics Proper. And so people were like, our editors were really pulling for that. But so they told us to just write the book as if it were a mature title, and we would see what we could get away with. And then they came back at us, and we found out the book was going to be 15+. But it just so happened that the first arc that we'd laid out and started writing was, from their point of view, okay to go from the 15+ perspective, and it didn't have to be edited at all. So so luckily we haven't felt constrained at all by the rating yet. Maybe there'll come a time where we write something and the editors just say, you know, we'd love to do it, but we can't in this iteration. But I guess we'll just cross that bridge when we get there. But it is nice that at least, you know, John's back to some of more of his bad old tricks.
Gotcha.
Awesome to hear. Very awesome to hear.
Yeah. I think this was really a great first issue in terms of setting up the story. And I feel like it benefited from repeated readings in a way that made me really happy as an investment of my... Well, actually, I paid significantly more than the cover price because I wanted the special variant cover, which I'd never paid for in the past, but there you go.
Oh, that's awesome.
Thank you. I noticed that one theme that goes between the preview that you did and the real issue is the question of coming out of and needing clothes. Does this sort of stem from your Project Runway background or certain tendencies in John's life? I don't know if it's a deliberate theme or coincidence.
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch the first part of the question. Clothes are a big theme?
Clothes, needing to get clothes fixed or making clothes or having to get clothes because you are standing naked in the pool of blood, most of which you don't know.
Well, you know, I mean, yes. The answer is yes to all of the blood. All of the blood, I said, because I was just thinking John covered in blood instead of clothes. To all of the above, not to all of the blood. Though the answer is also yes to all of the blood in Constantine. Yeah, I mean, clothes are a big part of life, John. As much as people have made it such a big point to say that John's character is the trench coat, his character is not the trench coat. His character is himself, and clothes are just a thing that he wears and has to deal with and contend with, like pretty much anyone else who is alive. So we're trying to treat it from that perspective as well, you know. He's not going to wear the same thing every issue. Actually, one person asked me, the DC panel special edition, if the trench coat would be coming back. And I said, he probably has several jackets in his closet, and one of them is probably a trench coat. And then they scowled at me like I killed their mother.
Oh, God.
But, you know, like, he's going to be wearing clothes of all different varieties, and they're going to come, he's going to have to put them on, and more often he's going to have to take them off, and probably they'll get shredded off of him and incinerated off of him and slimed off of him and everything, you know?
Right. No, but I was just talking in context of the woman who was the tailor and who was the woman in the preview issue who...
Oh, yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know. We're not really looking to make clothes a thematic element at this point, but they might just end up being a thematic element because I like clothes so darn much.
Okay, so that's my I guess that's my Project Runway question. Do you, in terms of like the characters' past and punk rock music and things like that, are there going to be? Is there much of an interest in connecting his story with pop culture history, or like did there?
Yeah, for sure. And again, I can't say too much for fear of spoiling the arc. I don't want to drop any spoilers, but, you know, John comes from a punk rock past. He's been de-aged to the point where he would have been a young man in the 90s and early 2000s. I think he's about 35 right now. So, you know, he's going to, if we ever see him when he's younger, he'll be in the garb of the era.
And Mucus Membrane is still the name of his band in canon.
Yeah, Mucus Membrane, still a punk band, but, you know, not operating in the 1970s scene. They would have been a punk band when ska was really big, so it would have been extra punk because they were super against authority.
That's really cool, and a great example, though, of, like, how certain things that are seen as being are really not as time period specific as certain kinds of purists might have you believe.
It is interesting. I mean, we talk about the time period a lot, and our editor Andy Corey is a huge music nut, specifically of alternative music from the 90s and 2000s. So he has a lot of thoughts about how John and Mucus Membrane should be portrayed. So I think if we ever go back into that time, people can expect a very based in authenticity take on the whole scene and situation.
Excellent. Oh, that'll be fun when that happens. Very cool. Very cool. So I guess we spoke a little bit about your art process earlier. I just had like one sort of final question on that. Have you always been doing your digitally? Have you mostly been doing your art digitally the whole time you've been making comics, or?
For the most part, I started out doing it traditionally. I did two full-length graphic novels at a young adult publisher that were kind of vampire werewolf romance graphic novels back in the late 2000s. You know, riding on the supernatural craze a little bit. And those I drew completely with pen and ink. But ever since I drew Mara at Image with Brian Wood in 2011 and 2012, I've been completely digital since that series. So yeah, I don't know, it just really helps my workflow. It's a lot cleaner. I have a lot less ink disasters, and it makes inking with actual ink more of kind of a special thing that I can do in my fun free time. You know, the Cintiq in my computer are for work, and then the sketchbook is for fun again.
Gotcha. Oh, that's interesting. I remember looking at your piece with Nightcrawler. That was in the Marvel Women Comics one-off piece.
That was inked traditionally. That was one of my inky pieces.
It was a really cool piece, by the way. Which I think one of the only pieces from that book that I can actually remember and identify and like say what it was. So.
Thank you. Yeah, the writer is G. Willow Wilson, so she's she ain't half bad either.
Nope.
She went nowhere. We haven't heard her since.
Yeah, I know. No, a lot of great creators were spotlighted in that Girl Comics series and initiative. So, and my editor on that was Janine Schaefer, who's worked at both Marvel and DC and is quite the awesome lady herself. So she put together a cool roster there.
Yeah, those are like a good step to like sort of show people who there were out there and available to be making work, you know?
Yeah. And that was some of my first published mainstream comic work as well. So I was very excited to have the opportunity to do that. I think it was the first thing I ever did for Marvel. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I guess that would be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Britt, did you have anything else you wanted to?
No,
I
mean,
we've been talking a lot.
Oh, no, it's all good. I like it when you're excited and you get tons of questions in. No, I mean, we've been talking for an hour and, you know, I don't want to take up too much of her time. I'm sure she has to make comments.
Yeah,
so.
Let's wrap it up. I got to go back to work. I'm sorry I gapped so much. I feel like you said a sentence and then I just went with it for 15, 20 minutes each time. I'm sorry.
No, that's perfect. That's good.
This has been
a lot of fun. So thank you.
So wordy.
For real.
Yeah,
for real.
No, it's my pleasure, and I'm so glad that you guys like the book.
Love the book.
Totally.
Yes.
We really do, and I hope you'll come back and join us again maybe later when we can like look back upon the first arc of the book or something along those lines and discuss it knowing more at that point than we do at this moment. So, I hope you'll join us again.
Absolutely. I am always around, just like Superman.
Well, for folks who are listening, we want to give you the platform to pitch. If you want, to give your website, Twitter account, wherever people can follow you and keep up to date, go for it.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can find me at mingdoyle.com and at pretty much any social media platform, I'm at mingdoyle. So Twitter, at mingdoyle, Instagram, at mingdoyle, Tumblr, mingdoyle.tumblr.com. It's amazing. But, if you just Google my nice little memorable multicultural name, you will find me.
Excellent.
Nice.
Well, thanks.
Cool.
Great. Thank you so much, you guys. It was great talking, and hopefully you continue to enjoy John's wily ways, and I'll talk to you later.
Yes,
thanks.
Appreciate it.
Talk
thanks so
later.
Much for coming on.
All right. Bye.
Yeah, bye. Well, I learned a lot.
Totally.
Really cool that they... The great thing of that, the one I wondered, it was like, there was so much talk of DC going into the kind of new era where they're like want to have all these different characters and actually be representative of people, where they made it made an effort and specifically did the bisexual aspect in like the first issue on purpose. Like, it's so great to hear.
Uh-huh.
It makes me so
and
happy.
And have it not be awkward like it was in the comic that I didn't mention the name of because I love the writer in it. Surprised me how badly it was done.
Bravo for Dan Tinker, by the way.
I'm sorry?
Well, I said bravo for Dan Tinker, by the way.
Yeah.
The way you handled
it. If it was somebody who I didn't like, I would have been like, that horrible thing by a person, XYZ. But instead, it's like, that bizarre misstep by this excellent writer whose name I won't be mentioning. I do feel like it's, probably has something to do with James, working on the title of being a bisexual man himself. It was really cool to hear him write about or being talking about that in the interviews that I saw. Had something to do with it being presented in a way that didn't seem like it was being performed. Yay.
Yeah. I had no idea about that until you said that. I was like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense now.
Mm-hmm. There was an excellent review. I don't normally pimp other people's sites in our show, but there's a really good review of the book on the Rainbow Hub not by Emma, but by a different writer there who had linked to an interview that he had done where he talked about that extensively. So that's where I picked up that factoid. But it's also just a really good interview. So, yeah, so I know that we're going to have one of the... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, well, just send the link and I post it up. It sounds like a really good read.
Cool. So, yeah, we're going to actually do something about Huff Imcon was Awesome in the near future so folks can hear what that was like. I did a digest sort of all of my favorite social media coverage from FlameCon that you guys can find on graphicpolicy.com right now if you want to go and check it out. It's tweets and Instagrams and pictures and things like that. So if folks want to get a sense of what they missed, they can go there and check it out. And I seriously endorse this convention. It was amazing, and people should go to great lengths to attend the next year. And yes, there will be a next year. I just don't have enough good things to say about it. It's pretty rare for me to feel like a queer space and a geek space, like individually or together, are as inclusive feeling as that one was. So bravo.
Yeah, and everything you posted, like, it looks fantastic. I'm tempted to come up next year to check it out.
Cool.
Just to see it. I mean, it looked like it was, like, a great vibe and fantastic. You know, people were having a good time. And, shit, let's be honest, it's an aspect of comics that, you know, doesn't get enough coverage and praise. And there's some really fantastic stuff out there in the queer comic sector. So, yeah, I think it would definitely be cool. I'm kind of shocked that this was the first one in New York. I would have sworn
that
there was one before.
Yeah, there had been like queer video game conferences here.
Yeah.
Specific one. There was a sort of academic convention that was held. I feel bad that I hadn't mentioned it sooner. There was sort of a more academic conference that was held at CUNY in May, actually, but it was not... It was the kind of thing that, like, the only reason I knew about it is because I know someone who works for CUNY and is a comics fan. It was really not something that was broadcast to the broader fan world. It was much more focused on academics, and it sounded like it was awesome, but it was not, I bet you there was very little overlap between the people who attended on Saturday and the people who attended the CUNY conference.
Yeah, I don't find those conferences overlap a whole lot. The academic ones are very academic. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But yeah, you can find your article if people want to check out about FlameCon as part of the carousel that's going on now, among other things that are being covered. We got some E3 coverage, thanks to Patrick, who's a friend of the site, and I know from some video games work that we've done together. But yeah, so that would be really cool to get to talk FlameCon. I don't think we have anything nailed down for next week.
Yep.
All right. Well, cool. We'll definitely be doing a show next week. It might be a catch-up episode since we haven't had one in a while where we just talk comics. But until then, you can follow us every single day at graphicpolicy.com. And, of course, we're on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, well, pretty much everywhere, all at Graphic Policy. We keep it nice and consistent. I want to thank Ming Doyle again for coming on. Really, really cool to hear what she had to say and learn more a bit about Constantine and thoughts about that and some hints at where things are going, which I think is pretty cool. But until next time, I'm Brett.
And I'm Ilana.
And keep it geeky.